This is Culturetopia, your weekly roundup of NPR's very best arts and cultural reportage. I'm Netta Ulibi of NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Linda Holmes, editor of NPR's arts and entertainment blog, Monkey See.
As always, subscribing to this podcast is possible at npr.org/culturetopia. This week,
the final work of Ralph Ellison is completed by two different editors.
And a long-looked-over diary throws new light on the work of author William Faulkner.
And Bollywood movie star Shah Rukh Khan discusses his new film. But first,
if you tuned into the Winter Olympics opening ceremonies in Vancouver last Friday, you likely heard Canadian singer Katie Lang. This year, Ms. Lang also celebrates a silver anniversary, 25 years of recording. To mark it, she's releasing a retrospective, songs, music videos, and live performances in a package called Recollection. NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports that Katie Lang's soaring vocal range comes from discipline and deliberate choices.
Way back in 1994, Katie Lang was a surprise guest on Tony Bennett MTV Unplugged. When Bennett introduced her, he said she was in a league of singers that were blessed with a destiny.
Billie Holiday, Edith Piaf, Hank Williams. It goes beyond success. It becomes immortal. This is one of the artists that will go up on the shelf with them.
It's company Katie Lang deserves to keep.
I heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord. You don't really care for music, do you? Well, it goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall, the major lift, the baffled king composing.
I always think of my voice as kind of like a fruit tree, you know. It has its natural tendency to create fruit, but at the same time there's ways to, you know, to protect it from the frost or to you know, fertilize it or to prune it at the right time.
Katie Lang says she practically builds her life around keeping her voice in shape.
I don't sing anything that hurts my voice. The way I eat, the way I sleep, what I drink. I mean, I don't even like going to parties because it's too loud and I have to talk too loud. I'm not crazy. I'm not sleeping in an oxygen chamber or anything like that. But I just try to just live a really natural, kind of simple life because I think obviously life has an impact on your voice.
That kind of discipline is something Katie Lang learned a long time ago from her mom, who was a second grade teacher determined to give her four children music lessons.
And every week on Thursday, and this is in the middle of Alberta in the winter, she would work all day and then drive four kids 60 miles one way through blizzards. And then sit there for 2 hours while we each had our half an hour lesson or something, and then drive back. We wouldn't get home till like 7 o'clock. And she did that for maybe 20 years.
And for the next 20 years, Katie Lang's popularity skyrocketed. Her new retrospective spans more than 20 years. Remember Katie Lang as the cowgirl / performance artist?
I watch. I wait. My heart is bound to break tonight.
There's also a song she wrote and recorded just a few months ago.
The alchemy of inner worlds, can I possibly explain?
Brave girl, alchemy, in a song.
It doesn't sing that well. I'm going to warn the young songwriters of America. It doesn't actually sing that well.
But if you're Katie Lang, you make it work. Let's face it, Katie Lang was born with a beautiful voice that she doesn't take for granted.
It's something I take a big responsibility in looking after.
Responsibility, discipline, natural talent. Katie Lang can add to that list endurance. Her first career retrospective, called Recollection, comes out this week. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Now, of course, Katie Lang sang a rousing rendition of Leonard Cohen's classic song, Hallelujah, at the Winter Olympics on Friday.
She did indeed.
Now, Linda, speaking of the Olympics, I have to say that I watched minutes, maybe just seconds, of an event that I really disliked until you turned me on.
Oh, awesome.
To the joys of shooting and skiing simultaneously.
Oh, shooting and skiing. It's so good. The great thing about biathlon, okay, first of all, if you're going to watch cross-country skiing, it should definitely be broken up with shooting guns.
And that was our producer, Mike Gatson, unable to contain himself.
So you there should definitely be guns. And in fact, I have heard several people comment that, you know, many Olympic sports would be better if there was shooting in the middle of them. Like figure skating and downhill skiing. I think there is a Saturday Night Live skit where there's downhill skiing and people getting shot. I can't remember what it has something to do with. I don't know. Anyway, the biathlon, too, is one of these events where until you watch it, you don't really understand what the specific skill is. But the specific skill in biathlon, of course, is that they're cross-country skiing. They get incredibly, you know, it's at this incredible level of exertion, and they're all sweaty and, you know, their hearts are pounding. And then you're supposed to sit there and shoot at this little teeny tiny target that's very, very far away. So you have to sort of be, it's like a mind-calming competition. It's you have to have this incredible control over your brain so that you can sort of shut everything off and become very, 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 very quiet in your head all at once.
And the other thing you said that you loved about it was in no other sport that if you fall down, for example, are you punished by it?
This is the way biathlon works if you've never seen it. You know, if you miss one of the targets when you're doing the shooting, you have to go off and ski an extra little circle over on this separate track. And it's like running laps in gym. You have to, if you mess up, you have to go and go around the track extra times. It was sort of fascinating to me. From that to something slightly more serious, Netta, a story that has been waiting to be told or published for decades. Famed author Ralph Ellison, who wrote the literary classic Invisible Man, was working on a highly anticipated second novel when he died of pancreatic cancer in 1994. Two editors were given access to his archive and have put the final touches on Ellison's final work 3 days before the shooting. NPR's Michelle Martin recently spoke with the two editors, John Callahan, literary executor of the Ellison Estate, and Adam Bradley, about how they managed to complete Ellison's unfinished work.
You actually played a role in sort of sorting out some of his material and kind of figuring out that part of it was that he'd kind of fallen in love with a computer.
Yeah, I mean, Ellison was one of the early adopters among writers of this new technology. So as early as the 1980s, very early 1980s, he got this laptop computer. It's called an Osborne, and it weighed about, you know, 25 pounds. You know,
even more than the book.
Oh, my God. Yeah, barely. You know, this was a monster. And he started typing away at this tiny little green screen monitor, 3 or 4 inches across. And he refashioned the novel over the next decade plus into a series of really a kind of a high literary jigsaw puzzle for someone like Ellison, who started working by, you know, actually writing out longhand. When he was a young man, he'd draft things out in pencil and write out in passages from Hemingway just to get the feel of the pen on the page. And then he moved to the typewriter, to the electric typewriter, and finally to this laptop. For him, I mean, what a story. I mean, in some ways, it's a story in miniature of the 20th century in writing and the way the tools that writers use and the effect that it has. For Ellison, one of the effects was that it allowed him to pile draft upon draft of the same scene over and over again without solving some of the basic questions of plot and transition that bedeviled the book.
And you don't solve it for him.
No.
In this
absolutely not.
Work. But John, I have to ask about the decision to publish what it is that you've published. The title of the book is 3 Days Before the Shooting. I'm going to ask you about where that comes from, but the unfinished second novel. And there are those who argue that if he didn't finish it, by definition, it isn't his novel. So how do you make the decision of what to publish and when?
What we did was, Juneteenth is a book that is the central narrative, I thought, of this saga. We said, well, look, let's then bring out the narratives, put them together as exactly as Ralph wrote them in the most complete and the most revised sequences that he wrote. So this is what he left four principal narratives, whereas Juneteenth was one, plus two shorter ones. And we had this discussion, shall we say, with the Modern Library, that their copy editor thought that the novel was submitted by a living person, perhaps who was somewhat of a neophyte writer. So we just said, no, this material is going to be published as Ralph left it.
You can hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia. Every artist draws on different modulations, and those are not always obvious. Even William Faulkner, everyone's favorite Southern Gothic Nobel Prize-winning writer, it turns out that the names of some of the slaves in some of his most well-known books are also the names of slaves that are in a plantation diary that are sitting in an archive. And even though this diary had been known about for decades, the parallels between what was in this diary and what Faulkner wrote really weren't explored until an administrator and part-time English professor at Emory University started working on a book. Her name's Sally Wolf King, and she discusses this discovery with NPR's Michelle Norris. She says the story of this discovery began when she met Dr. Edgar Wiggin Francisco, the great-great-grandson of the plantation owner who wrote the diary.
I happened to turn to a page that showed the individual amounts of monies paid for slaves, and I realized that it looked very similar to the slave sale records section of Godel Moses. And so I asked Dr. Francisco if he'd read Godel Moses, and he said no. So I asked whether his father had ever read Godel Moses, and he said no, he didn't think so. I was struggling to figure out why Faulkner's novel would resemble this diary or vice versa. And eventually I said, well, you had been telling me that your dad and William Faulkner visited frequently at each other's homes. Do you think he ever saw this diary? And Dr. Francisco said, yes, he liked to look at it.
Can you tell us about some of the discoveries that are clearly spotted in some of William Faulkner's works, things that you found as you came to learn more about that farm ledger and that farm in Holly Springs?
Yes, I noticed Candace and Ben are names of slaves on the Leek Plantation, and they also figure as prominent characters in The Sound and the Fury. And Ben, who is a slave, the diary says, was not sound. Benji is likewise not sound. His disability is mental slowness. And other names, Meek and Dalton, appear in both the diary and The Sound and the Fury.
The original manuscript was written by Francis Terry Leek. He was a very wealthy plantation owner. And it's interesting because Faulkner would give some of his white characters slave names from that ledger. What do you make of that? Is that a window into William Faulkner's political views?
Well, I think it will be interpreted in various ways. But in Godel Moses, for example, Faulkner does imbue his characters with hope for the future and a sense that condition of slavery might be alleviated and at least points toward the possibility of freedom. So for him to take slave names and make important characters out of them, it seems to me that he was recovering their names and stories and activities and perhaps even commemorating their lives and marking their graves in a memorial to a forgotten people.
You know, there's another kind of story that we don't always hear a lot about in American mainstream culture, and that involves the movies that come out of Bollywood. And even if you have never heard of Shah Rukh Khan, a billion people in India have. He's the biggest draw in the outrageously oversized films that come from Bollywood. Indian movies made in Bombay play across South Asia, the Middle East, Africa, and beyond, and more people around the world watch Shah Rukh Khan than Meryl Streep or Brad Pitt. At age 44, he owns a production company and is host of India's version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And he keeps starring in Bollywood productions, shown everywhere from distant Indian villages to multiplexes in New York. In his latest production, which is being released in the United States, his character has Asperger's syndrome. After 9/11, this Muslim man is driven to constantly repeat a single explosive phrase.
My name is Khan. And I'm not a terrorist.
Steve Inskeep recently spoke to Khan about the film.
The film is not about 9/11 or terrorism. It's a love story. And just the backdrop, an incident happens on television, as we all saw. And the butterfly effect of an incident like this, that, you know, two people who are actually completely unrelated to an incident somewhere in the world and how their lives and their love changes or gets completely thwarted.
Soon after he finished filming My Name is Khan, India's biggest film star almost found himself thwarted. On a visit to the United States, he was detained and questioned for 2 hours at U.S. immigration. The incident made front page headlines across India.
I didn't react to it as vehemently as I think everyone else back home did, because I'm used to it. My name is Khan, really, and it kind of becomes on the security, and I'm sent to the other side, which is okay. I don't make a big issue out of it. As a matter of fact, the foreign minister in India said that, we're also going to do the same to the Western world people when they come. So I said, give me the chance to frisk Angelina Jolie if she comes to India, please. I should be the first one to try this.
This movie seems a little different than many other films that you've made, because I think it's fair to describe many of your films as secular in character. Perhaps someone would presume that you're playing a Hindu character, but the main character's religion, your character's religion, is not central to the plot. Is it a risk at all to be making a movie where you are explicitly identified as a Muslim?
No, I don't think so. I think, yes, our films are very secular. Because, like I said, they're mostly of the cabaret variety ones. People call it stereotype. I think it's a hero type. India has a lead actor always has a hero type. He's a hero. He flies and he jumps and he sings and he dances and does all the good things that you can imagine or fantasize about. But in this case, I think the film required us to take it a bit seriously. As far as the public is concerned, India is amazingly secular. Just to explain it to you, I'm a Muslim, but I am a leading star for the last 20 years. So, if you just go by that, there is no issue ever, secular issues in our country. But yes, there are vested interests who will always bring that up to provoke people, which keeps on happening, I guess, everywhere.
There's another thing about this movie that may illustrate something about Indian cinema and something about India, in that your character comes to America. This is one of many films that you've been in, that other stars have been in, where it's kind of about Indians abroad. Why is that?
I have done a lot of films where the characters do come to America or London or to the Western part. See, Indian fantasies are very real. I say this to everyone. Our fantasies are about earning a good living, having maybe a car, not two, getting education for your kids. Our fantasies are not about getting the president of the country to sit in a rocket and go and break a meteor. Our fantasies are very real. As a matter of fact, everyone turns around and tells me, your films are so fantastic. And I find the Western cinema very fantastic. You've got aliens and you've got things that we don't know about and we believe
them. 9-foot-tall blue creatures.
Yeah, blue creatures, and you have Batman and you have Superman. I remember the first time I was here, I think somebody was interviewing me in a hotel and they said, your films are such fantasies. And I'm like, we are fantasies? Our guys just want to sing and dance on the roads. Our guys just want to drive a big car. Our guys just want to come to America. We don't want to go to Pandora. So it's like our films are very really fantastic, they're achievable fantasies. So it's a big thing, coming to the Western world. You have tall buildings, you have nice cars, you have big roads. So we just try to expose that in the Indian world.
You can hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia. Rapper Lil Wayne is one of those stars whose influences stretches well beyond hip-hop horizons. He was one of last year's biggest touring acts. He's been interviewed by Katie Couric. Even President Obama has mentioned his name a few times. But he's also had some run-ins with the law. Last week, a New York judge told Lil Wayne, born Dwayne Carter, that he could not postpone going to jail past March 2nd. He pleaded guilty last year on gun possession charges. But commentator Donnell Alexander says Lil Wayne will represent a new model for rappers going to jail.
It's no secret that you could gain credibility by having a sort of a pedigree in the pen as a rapper. That's sad, and it is what it is inside of society and out. And with Lil Wayne, it's a situation where he was busted after a show in New York for having a gun on the bus, his tour bus, I should say. It's kind of a mundane offense in the world of hip-hop. But people have become anesthetized to the idea of a rapper going to jail. I think it's important with Wayne because he's sort of an everyman, and his music is down and dirty, but there's always been an element of instructiveness to it. We get money, man, I show you how to turn a profit. A really good example would be that song, The Prophet, that he did with Fat Joe, and just one simple line. After his verse of braggadocio, you have him talking about stop hating, get your money on. Yo, the money home, stop hating, get your money on.
We get money, man, I show you how to turn a profit.
And the fact of the matter is that it's easy to be down in the dumps about being broke and all that and to hate on other people, be jealous. But if you really focus on getting your career or your life straight, there isn't so much to stop you. And I don't think a lot of rappers today especially stop to take the time to suggest you move forward with your life.
My mind shines even when my thoughts seem dark. Pistol on my neck, you don't want to hear that thing talk.
And he's really done this amazing sort of run up to Lock Up. He's been everywhere. He's part of the We Are the World Haiti remix that's coming out. And most prominently, there was his performance at the Grammys the other night. He brought down the house with Drake, one of the artists on his label, Eminem. I mean, people didn't even notice that Kanye West wasn't there. It was that big hit. Where once going to jail is just part of the rapper persona, I think for Wayne right now, it's part of a business plan. He has a label, Young Money Entertainment, that is going to keep him front and center while he's in prison. First of all, they're moving from New Orleans to New York to be closer to him while he's up at Rikers Island. Wayne himself has recorded an album's worth of material for the time while he's locked up. It's a rock album, so this will also be his big venture into crossing over even more than he has already. His label has pretty much made every effort to make it seem like he's not gone while he's actually gone. And I think that when he comes out, he'll be much bigger than when he left.
That's it for this week.
You can find links to all the stories we had today and subscribe to the podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Linda Holmes.
And I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.